Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Separation of church and state hardly precludes discussion of issues with significant religious overtones during a political campaign, this year no exception. Little wonder religious groups spend nearly $400 million a year lobbying in Washington. Many of those issues are of special concern to Catholics and the Catholic Church. One in four voters is Catholic. Since 1972, every presidential candidate who has won the popular vote has won the Catholic vote. A public forum will be held at Fontbonne University this Thursday titled Faithful Citizenship, a Forum on Religion and Public Life. Joining me in studio to talk about the forum and the issues are two participants. Julie Hannon Rubio is Associate Professor of Christian Ethics at St. Louis University. Randy Rosenberg is Professor of Religion and Philosophy at Fontbonne University. Joining us a little later will be Rusty Reno, editor of First Things, a journal of religion, culture, and public life. Julie and Randy, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to have you here.
Thanks for inviting us.
Thank you, Don.
Julie, let me begin with you. Give me a quick take, if you would, on the role of religion and faith this election cycle.
Well, it's an exciting time to be teaching about religion and politics and thinking about it. I think a lot of people are asking the question, what does it mean to be a person of faith, and how do I bring my faith into the public realm? People don't want to impose their faith on others. They believe in the separation of church and state, and yet they often feel convicted that their faith should influence their choices.
Mm-hmm. Randy, how about you? Do you have the same take?
A very similar take, I think, in terms of our context, the Catholic context, there's a real institutional emphasis on something we call Catholic social thought. And it's often referred to as our best-kept secret. But in many ways, what Catholic social thought is an attempt to bring faith commitments, the spirit of the Gospels, to bear on issues that relate to modern economics, modern politics, contemporary culture. And so there's a real drive and a real emphasis in the Catholic tradition, and it makes sense why there's so much conversation around Catholicism, the Catholicism of the candidates, and so on in this election season.
I wonder how much individual Catholics, though, abide by that thought and follow that thought and follow their faith on key issues. Any idea?
Well, I think it varies a great deal. Like Randy said, a lot of people aren't informed, although when I talk more and more to students, they are aware of some of the principles and they can talk about things like the dignity of the human person, respect for life, solidarity, subsidiarity, things like this. And I think people maybe feel that the general principles should guide them. There's a fair amount of evidence that Catholics really value, in particular, our tradition's option for the poor and the vulnerable, and see that as shaping their choices.
Randy, how about young people versus those who are a little bit older? The same approach?
Well, I think I find the issue of young people different in terms of engaging them, different and similar in terms of politics. For example, in a class the other day, I just asked my students straight up, do you care about politics? Let's have a conversation about politics. And there were a few that said, oh, I'm highly animated by politics and thinking about the issues of religion and faith. But there was also a large majority who suggested that they were turned off by both the soundbite nature of politics, by that they were stressed out by the constant arguments. And so some of them just suggested that they are kind of opting out. Now, when I did a poll on who actually will be voting, and for many of them, this will be their first election, I would say three-fourths of the class said they would vote. So we have that element that I think is prominent, a kind of opting out or that young people are wary of politics. On the other hand, what I also find among groups of young people at our university and beyond is an attempt to move beyond the kind of the traditional liberal-conservative divide that kind of marks politics. So it's not uncommon to find on campuses and beyond in youth groups, for example, for young people to care about issues like abortion or human dignity. But at the same time, they care just as much about sex trafficking, about the death penalty. So it seems to me there's an element among young people where they're trying to transcend the divide. I mean, that's part of the issue raised to people of faith is, you know, you say you care about one issue, but what about all the other issues? Mm-hmm. So I sense a movement among young people that attempts to transcend that divide.
Julie, you work with young people every day. Are you seeing the same thing?
I am. There is that combination that Randy's speaking to, the disillusionment, a sense that everyone's corrupt and why should I pay attention, that nothing will change anyway. So there's some of that. And then there's also a sense that the parties don't capture what they think. And some of our students, they'll go to the March for Life, but then they'll march against war. They care deeply about human dignity across the spectrum. And they find themselves to be, in some senses, politically homeless, which some bishops have suggested all Catholics ought to feel because no party fully captures what we would want.
Do you have a sense that faith has been hijacked by politicians?
Hijacked. Well,
taken it over, just grabbed it for themselves to use as an issue, not necessarily with any principle behind it.
Sometimes, perhaps. I don't know what you think about this, Randy. I mean, I actually think there's been some fairly serious discussion in this election, particularly because Paul Ryan has started talking about Catholic social teaching. And so now all of a sudden we don't have politicians simply using generic religious language. People are actually trying to engage the substance of the tradition. And so as Paul Ryan has claimed Catholic social teaching, other Catholics have argued with him and said, no, that's not what we mean. And so we actually, I think, have a more substantive debate about faith and politics than perhaps we have in previous elections.
I think that came to the fore when we witnessed Sister Simone Campbell, who ended up giving an address at the Democratic National Convention.
Let's just specify who we're talking about here. Not everyone's familiar with the name.
Okay. Sister Simone Campbell, trying to recall the name of the network, a lobbying network in D.C. I think it's called Network.
Network.
Called
yeah.
Network.
Yeah.
And she began this tour that came to be called Nuns on a Bus, and it began in the middle of June, and a two-week tour throughout the country protesting the Ryan budget. Mainly, in what ought to be noted, I think, is protesting it in light of her appropriation of Catholic social teaching. And her concern was the budget cut key social services that would benefit the poor and the vulnerable. So we have Sister Simone on the one hand and Paul Ryan on the other hand, both of whom are Catholic, both of whom are speaking out of this Catholic social tradition and coming to different prudential judgments about how to best apply that in the public realm. So I would agree with Julie that in places we have at least witnessed, no matter, you know, which or to whom you give your who you think is most convincing, there has been a more serious debate in the public realm.
What about the women religious in general? Had their annual convention here just a month or two ago. What role does all of this play in the political world, Julie? Do you have any sense that it's part of it?
Oh, I think that women religious really have come into public view in a way that they really haven't been before, as they've been speaking out on behalf of the poor and the vulnerable. And they do that, I think, with a sense of authenticity that comes from their work in the trenches with people who are homeless, with elderly, with victims of AIDS, all kinds of things. And so they when they speak about their worry about spending cuts, I think people take them seriously. So I think it's been a great moment for women religious, really, in this country as they've been speaking out.
One gets the sense that they have a tremendous amount of support amongst Catholics throughout the United States.
Oh, I think that's certainly true on many levels. And I think part of the support, I think, to contextualize it is to note how important women religious were both in sort of the founding of our country and establishing health care and education, and particularly in St. Louis, where they've had a powerful influence. Fontbonne, for example, is sponsored by the Sisters of St. Joseph of Carondelet, coming to St. Louis after the French Revolution, but being a part of education, deaf education, working with working with slaves and others who were disenfranchised. So it seems to me we have to acknowledge the powerful presence of the sisters, and they certainly have support. I think to get a whole view on the situation, there are many in the Catholic community around the country who are I think it's what you're referring to, Don, is there's some significant tension between some of the bishops and these women religious orders, and so I think to acknowledge support for sure, but if we round it out, there's also critique. Those more you would say on the right, George Weigel, for instance, the papal biographer, told the story recently or wrote about the encounters of a group of sisters in New York, and somebody came up to them and said, "You're a sister, aren't you proud of Sister Simone Campbell?" And their response was, "You know, we aren't proud because she didn't address certain issues that are dear to us and dear to Catholic social thought." So I only point that out to say that it's extremely complicated. But I think in general what I said before, to acknowledge, as Julie did, the work of the sisters in our country on behalf of the poor and the vulnerable, both historically and currently, we cannot ignore.
Well, there are politics and there is politics, sometimes within the church and sometimes outside the church. And seems like a pretty hefty political load being carried these days inside the church.
Yes, and I think people are raising some really important questions. So the women religious are asking for a circle of protection to be placed around programs for people who are poor and vulnerable, for the elderly. And they worry that Paul Ryan's budget seems to begin with cutting those kinds of programs. And yet other Catholics are asking, can we simply put a circle of protection around these programs? Do we have to ask questions of effectiveness? And are all these programs really working? Are there better ways, perhaps, that we could even better help the people that we want to help?
I think we've got to give Joe Biden some equal time here. He is also Catholic, and he is also out there stumping. You've pointed at Congressman Ryan. What about Vice President Biden and his role and his faith?
It's interesting, although there's been a lot of talk about how we have two Catholic vice presidential candidates. I don't hear Biden speaking as much directly about his faith, although some have argued that he represents the older kind of liberal Catholic Democrat, and Paul Ryan represents the new Catholic Republican, focused more on respect for life issues and the principle of subsidiarity. So perhaps I would say that I'm not sure it's as much old and new as a tension that's within the tradition itself.
Okay. I would agree with Julie. I mean, even to highlight the importance of the principle of subsidiarity, it's played a key role in the conversation.
All right. Well, we've given Joe Biden, I think, some equal time here. There was an interesting piece on NPR this morning in which they pointed out that the issues of overt faith and overt religiosity is much less this time around than it was in the last campaign. That now candidates aren't talking about their relationship with God. They're talking about their relationship to the golden rule. Do you see this change? Is it less of an overt stance that politicians at the national level are taking this time than it was in 08?
It does seem so. I think that Jimmy Carter, for instance, if we go even farther back as an evangelical, was very comfortable talking about his personal relationship with Christ, as was George W. Bush, and that seemed to be important in public discussions. Now we hear a different sort of conversation, and to me, it's an interesting conversation. Not that people's faith and relationship aren't important, but these issues of how do we move from faith to ethical stances and then into politics. I mean, that's where it gets complicated and interesting, and those are the conversations I think we're hearing. And I think you're right, they're different.
And I wonder, Don, if the prominence of the economy in this election has really focused away from speaking about religious belief, even at times posturing about religious belief, to people who are saying something needs to be done about the state of our lives and the state of our economic lives. So to focus instead on, you mentioned the golden rule, we can speak of kind of two principles of that ought to impact social life. One would be charity, And also another would be justice. So to think about both concrete organizations that provide charity and also, though, thinking through just structures, how you might say charity weaves itself into larger political structures. And you see more, I think, serious conversation about that today than before.
Okay, we have to take a break. We'll come back and we'll be joined by Rusty Reno, editor of First Things. He's going to join the conversation. My guests in studio are Randy Rosenberg, professor of religion and philosophy at Fontbonne University. Julie Rubio is associate professor of Christian ethics at St. Louis University. Our discussion today is the intersection between religion and politics, with special emphasis on the Catholic vote because it is such an important part of the vote every presidential year and in every election, needless to say. Back with Rusty Reno in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. I'm Don Marsh. Our discussion today is focusing on the intersection of religion and politics. We're paying special attention to the Catholic vote. And I would like to welcome Rusty Reno, the editor of First Things, which is a journal of religion, culture, and public life, who is joining us by phone from New York City. Rusty, thanks for being with us.
A pleasure to be with you.
Say hi to Randy Rosenberg and Julie Rubio.
Hello. Good to be with you guys.
Hey, Rusty.
Rusty, let me begin with you. One of the things that has to come into this conversation, and in a way has already, is the question of Catholic social teaching. We've talked a lot about the issues and how the economy dominates and some of the social issues, but one of the things that I have found missing in this campaign, which is very important to the Catholic social teaching and which others on this program at different times have commented on, is the lack of emphasis that national political candidates are putting on poverty in this country. That is inconsistent with Catholic teaching. How do you view that and its importance and the fact that national candidates seem to be bypassing it?
I guess we're primarily preoccupied with the kind of economic machine taken as a whole. I mean, we can't have effective poverty programs if we don't have the resources to devote to the poor. And so I think given the economic malaise since 2008, that's really what's forced first and foremost in people's minds.
How is that, Julie, likely to play out through this election amongst Catholic voters? Any sense of that?
Well, I might have a slightly different take. I mean, my own sense is that in the Catholic social tradition, that option for the poor and vulnerable is primary, and we're directed to make that our first question. How do these policies affect the poor? And it does seem to me that both candidates actually are speaking more about the plight of the middle class. And I think Rusty's right. The whole economy is the problem, and so we have to address that. But if we're not asking that question, how does this affect the poorest of the poor, then I think that then we're not asking the right question. And so my own sense is that then the bishops call Catholics in both political parties not to be transformed by their parties, but to try to transform those parties. And so that Catholics ought to be the ones in both parties saying, what about the poor?
Well, Randy, they all acknowledge the poor, but what are lacking are specific programs, unless we want to talk about cutting food stamps or cutting Medicaid, which is exactly the opposite of what Julie's talking about.
I think that's correct. Yeah.
I think that the issue here really has what people are concerned about is the sustainability of the programs that we put in place, first with the New Deal and then the Great Society in the 60s, expanded and developed in recent years. And so there's a concern about its sustainability, which I think is, it's a profoundly consequential to the most vulnerable members of our society who are so profoundly dependent on the programs that have been put in place in the last two generations.
So I sense that you're all in agreement that enough, for lack of a better term, lip service is being paid to this particular issue, that those of the poorest among us, you're satisfied with that. Julie?
I would say I'm not satisfied with that. I agree with Rusty that this issue of the sustainability of the programs we put in place is key. And it's not enough to simply say, I'm for the poor. I don't favor any cuts. We have to figure out how we can reasonably do this for years to come. But I still think we're asking too many questions about the middle class, given that the middle class in the U.S. is relatively, and I say that with full knowledge that that's a relative term, but relatively well off compared to those who are poor here and then poor in other parts of the world.
Well, Rusty, would you assume then, and maybe you don't want to assume because we all know that that can be very dangerous, would you assume, because the Republican Party is talking very vocally about the reduction in food stamps and also Medicaid, that the Catholic vote is likely to tilt toward the Democrats this time?
I don't think so. I think that the impulse, I mean, the question about food stamps and Medicaid is a question primarily of program design and whether or not we want to link it to work requirements or whether we want to make it connected to state-based programs versus a federally defined program. So I don't see that as being a sort of a primary concern. I think the primary concern when it comes to federal spending is, as Julie was right to say, this spending on middle-class entitlements, which is, you know, where the huge expenditures are. You know, the spending on poverty programs is not sort of threatening our fiscal well-being in the long term. It's really spending in middle-class entitlements, Social Security and Medicare.
Julie, you look like you might want to say something about that.
No, I agree with Rusty. I think that sometimes we can focus too much on both parties on the programs for the poorest. When really, yeah, it's the middle class who gets the most. And can we ask questions about that? Those are good questions.
Right,
because it's a danger that we wind up starving our programs for the poor in order to finance middle class entitlements that are in the long run unsustainable.
Okay. I'd like to move along to a couple of other things. We're getting a lot of calls, and I want to get to them as quickly as I can. 382-8255 is our number. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air, and you can also reach us through Facebook. But a couple of things I just want to put on the table now because they are important discussions within the Catholic community. One is abortion. Very quickly, how big an issue is that going to be during this political campaign? Julie?
Well, I think it's always a big issue for Catholics because it's foundational because we have this concern for human dignity and respect for life across the spectrum. So I think Catholics are concerned about that. I think what's different about this election started a little bit in 2008, but I think the question really coming to the fore now is what can we do to reduce the rate of abortion and so that we see Catholics engaging in conversations about what are the best strategies. Can we rely on things like support for new Supreme Court justice, the overturning of Roe v. Wade, a human life amendment? Are those realistic strategies? Are there other strategies like healthcare and support for women that might also be even more effective in reducing the abortion rate?
Well, I would suggest, Rusty, and I know you've written on this, I would suggest that some people might say that the way to deal with it is contraception. And contraception is a part of the dialogue today with regard to the Affordable Care Act and what Health and Human Services is charged with doing. Go ahead and take that one on. How big a deal is that going to be in the voting booth this time?
I think it's emerged as an important issue for Catholics. I mean, the Health and Human Services requirements that mandate free contraceptive coverage for plans that qualify under the Affordable Care Act, which really means all plans after 2014, what it does is it shifts the focus from what I would say is a kind of Catholics have to reconcile themselves to living in a pluralistic society where people disagree about the moral issues revolving around sex and sexuality, to a system where we are required to participate in at least the funding of the sexual revolution. And I think that's an important shift from sort of, look, hey, you have to accept the fact we live in a pluralistic society. okay, well, we can deal with that, to a situation where, no, you're required to participate in this aspect of it.
Does the fact that if what we read is true, and I assume it is because we've heard it from many different sources, the fact that 90% of Catholic women apparently use or have used contraception come into play here? Julie? Go ahead, Rusty. Finish up.
Well, I think that I'd like to hear Julie's thoughts on this also. But I think that this is an example of where, look, you know, people make up their own minds. They do what they do, what they do. But I think people distinguish between what they do and what the church, the right of the church to teach and run her institutions according to her own teachings. So I found I was kind of surprised by some of my more liberal Catholic friends, how they were rather taken aback by the when the contraceptive mandate was announced. It's like, hey, you know, we're fighting about contraception, but it's our fight within the church. You people stay out. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that statistic is going to be as determinative as people might think.
Julie?
I agree in part with Rusty. I think it doesn't settle the issue. That is, the fact that only a small percentage of Catholics follow the church teaching on natural family planning, maybe 2 or 3%, doesn't suggest that we can't say anything at all about it. It's our teaching, and perhaps we don't all follow the teaching the teachings about social justice either, but that doesn't mean we wouldn't want to run our institutions that way. At the same time, it seems significant to me because usually on issues of religious liberty, we're talking about individuals who feel convicted that they need to behave in ways that are in conflict with what the society has said is the law or social custom. And in this case, we don't have that. In fact, the majority of Catholics don't feel convicted along these lines. So it makes it more complicated.
Everything is complicated.
Yeah.
Everything is very complicated.
Yeah. I think it's important to point out as well how the bishops are articulating their opposition to this. And they're articulating it not in terms of the number of Catholics who do not agree with the teaching on contraception, but they're framing it in terms of religious freedom.
Exactly.
And it seems to me, just to give some context, that theme or the articulation of that theme comes out of the Second Vatican Council, of which we are now celebrating the 50th anniversary. There was a short and but important document called Dignitatis Humanae, all right, the decree on the Declaration on Religious Freedom, which championed really the right of conscience and attempted to say that that individuals and organizations ought to be protected to pursue religious freedom and it had a vision of a non-coercive state in that regard.
I'd like to go to the phones now, and I'm going to bring in Jackson calling from St. Louis because he wants to contribute to this part of the discussion. So, Jackson, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. My question is to the panel is this. There is an evidence that the use of Viagra among Catholic men have gone up, and they are still very much against use of contraception. How do you reconcile that?
Well, who wants to take that one? Anybody have a sense? Julie, you look like you might be ready to respond.
I'm not sure. I don't think Catholic theologians have really started to reflect on Viagra yet. Maybe just one or two things I've seen so far. That's interesting. I mean, clearly, Catholics, by and large, have decided to behave differently than their church would want them to on this issue. They've come to a conclusion that the teaching is not compelling, and there's just all kinds of evidence for that.
So it's not going to be potentially determinative in the voting booth this time, right? Rusty, Randy?
Well, no, I think that people make a distinction, and Julie's point about the Catholic Church's teaching on the poor is a good example of that. Most of us, you know, we got to commit to our families. We feel like, you know, it's not much I can do. But they still think, well, thank God the church stands up for this important moral principle. And I think the same thing has to do with sexual morality. You know, people do what they do, and so on. But I think that they want to protect the church's right to organize and proclaim these particular teachings, even if they don't necessarily conform to them. I think people can make that distinction. They go, oh, yeah, well, whatever, I'm not really going to buy into that. But thank goodness the church is standing up for its principles. And I think the HHS mandate is seen by people as the state dictating to the church what it can and can't, how it can and can't organize its institutions.
I think that's true in part, and certainly some Catholics and others, Protestants and people of other faiths also stand with the church's principle of religious freedom, even if they disagree on the particular issue. But others are less convinced. Even after the campaign for religious freedom over the summer, I don't think that support for Romney went up among Catholics and others. So some Catholics are quite worried especially because they don't want to lose the good of health care that we seem to have made some progress toward.
The Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life is out with some new polling statistics, by the way, and I won't give you the numbers, but for President Obama, support among white Catholics and mainline Protestants is very close to 50%, but that support is trending upward. For Mr. Romney, it is trending down below 50%, about the same area as President Obama, but it is moving down among the same group. So there seems to be a little movement for Obama and against Romney in conjunction with the Catholic vote again this time. I've got to take another break. I'll ask folks who are waiting on the phone to be patient. We'll come back and take your calls. We are talking about the intersection between religion and politics, particularly with regard to the Catholic vote, very important vote this year. With me in studio is Julie Rubio, Associate Professor of Christian Ethics at St. Louis University, Randy Rosenberg, Professor of Religion and Philosophy at Fontbonne University. Joining us from New York by phone is Rusty Reno, editor of First Things. That is a journal of religion, culture, and public life. And I wanted to mention also that the forum that I mentioned at the top of the program, the Fontbonne University Forum, Religion and Public Life, is at 7 o'clock on Thursday at the Dunham Student Activity Center. Randy Rosenberg and Julie Hanlon Rubio are speakers there. Are you part of that, Rusty? Part
yes,
of the forum? I'm sorry?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I am.
Yeah, good. Okay. All three of our guests will be a part of that. It is open to the public. We'll have more on that a little bit later. Back to the phone calls in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our discussion. And I'd like to go right to the phones because we have a number of people who have been waiting. We'll start with Bill in Jennings. He's been waiting the longest, and we thank you for your patience. Go ahead.
My question is, I think that, first of all, the panel is really not, and I mean this in the kindest possible way, but is really not qualified to talk about the Catholic vote any more than I would be qualified to talk about the men vote or the vote of people over 35. It's just too big of a and diverse group. And part of the reason I say that is because, as you mentioned before, very few people who call themselves practicing Catholics are actually Catholics. In fact, if you're in the 90% that uses birth control, then by defying that edict, you are, in fact, by definition, Protestant. And not only that, but I don't think the Catholic Church is ever going to have sway as long as they're filled with bigotry. And I just say that because if you're opposed to gay marriage on religious grounds, then you are, by definition, a bigot. And I think there are a lot of people like myself who grew up in the Catholic Church, had great experiences in the Catholic Church, but the teachings about sexuality, the teachings about birth control, teachings about all kinds of things are just completely incorrect in the modern world.
Bill,
I'll take my comments off the air.
All right, Bill. Thank you so much for those comments. Rusty, I'll give that one to you. Do you want to take it on?
I think he's making a very good point about the diversity of the Catholic vote. The most useful polling data will disaggregate people who self-identify Catholic and look at people who call themselves Catholic but rarely attend church, people who go to Mass once a week, and people who go to daily Mass. And it's interesting to see there's a strong difference. There's a big difference between people who self-identify as Catholic. They tend to vote Democrat, but if they don't go to Mass. If they do go to Mass, they tend to vote, not overwhelmingly, but strongly tilt Republican. People who go to daily Mass, interestingly, are slightly more likely to vote Democrat, which I think probably might have to do with an age factor there. But I think it's very important when people talk about the Catholic vote that people in America who self-identify as Catholic include, you know, a very large percentage of people who are very disaffected from the Catholic Church.
Is it fair to speak of any religious group in a monolithic fashion, the Catholic vote, the Protestant vote, the black vote? Is that fair?
Yes. I mean, I think that the black vote is quite monolithic. I mean, it's trending towards 90% Democrat. The Mormon vote is monolithic, equal and opposite in the Republican direction. People who self-identify as evangelical Protestant are overwhelmingly more likely to actually be church attenders. People who become disaffected from Protestantism consider themselves to have no religious affiliation, and they don't consider themselves to be culturally Protestant, typically. Catholicism is unique in this regard. It's a cultural identity as well as a religious identity.
Are people who are opposed to gay marriage bigots?
Am I supposed to field that one? I'm happy to.
Sure, please do.
I think it is irrational and bigoted to think that a person's moral status depends upon the color of their skin. I think it's profoundly reasonable to think a person's moral identity is related to their behavior. And that is the normal thing that people do in their moral life, is they make moral judgments about people's behavior. The Catholic Church makes moral judgments about people's sexual behavior. Now, you may think that that's the Catholic Church is mistaken, but to think that it's bigoted to make moral judgments about people's behavior is really winds up making it impossible to make moral judgments about any kind of behavior.
And the position, I think, is just to complicate things as well. Just to give voice to the way, you know, presently the Catholics are articulating the issue. One is to give heed to what Cardinal Dolan mentioned, you know, within the year, that hospital visitation rights are given now to gay couples, bereavement leave, and the like. And I would also just caution the supposition that a stance on gay marriage is as easy as equating it to bigotry, even if you disagree with that. Even the Catholicism or the Church in its present articulation says that gay people must be treated with respect, compassion. Any unjust sign of discrimination ought to be avoided. Now, some may argue, but we're trying to point out unjust signs or discriminatory signs. But I think it's important at least to give voice to the complicated way in which it's presently articulated.
And I would also not care for the term bigot, but I do think that many Catholics are beginning to rethink this issue. Theologians are, and ordinary Catholics are, and even a majority of Catholics broadly defined, for sure.
And non-Catholics, by the way.
Oh, absolutely. are coming to some it's easy and some it's very difficult, but they're coming to think about it differently, and they're asking what does it mean for us to protect marriage and defend marriage, and does it have to mean this particular way? Are there other ways in which we can strengthen marriage in our communities and our churches, help reduce the divorce rate, prepare couples better for marriage? Those ways maybe would be ways that we could support marriage without taking on this battle.
Could Catholics comfortably change their views on this if the Vatican says no?
Well, they have. Mm-hmm. And I think the caller speaks to this as well. I mean, are these people Catholic? My own position would be siding with the majority of Catholic moral theologians, who of course could be just dead wrong, which is that it's possible for Catholics to in conscience, after prayer and study and reflection and formation of conscience, to come to disagreement with the Church on concrete moral norms and still remain Catholic.
Anybody else want to weigh in on that before we move along?
I think Julie is certainly right about the Church does teach us to obey our conscience, but I think that I think these tend to be package deals. In other words, a person who's changed his or her mind about the Church's teaching on homosexuality often has changed his or her mind about a whole range of issues, And at some point, I think one has to be honest with oneself and ask oneself whether one's conscience is being formed by the church, or is it being formed by our ambient culture. And that's an important question that I think all Catholics who are in dissent from the church need to be asking themselves.
Back to the phones, and we'll bring in Edie calling from Overland. Edie, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Yes, I must make a comment about a comment that Rusty made about Social Security being an entitlement. Social Security is not an entitlement. It is a trust fund. The government hasn't contributed one dime to my Social Security fund. And I resent it being called an entitlement, not only by Rusty, but by the population at large. It is not an entitlement.
Edie, thank you so much for the call. Rusty,
thank you.
Rusty, would you like to respond to Edie?
The luckiest people in the world were people who retired 10, 20 years ago. What they have received in Social Security benefits would have constituted a fabulous investment if it was indeed a trust fund. The current Social Security system is an income transfer from current working people to retired people, and the trust fund concept is rhetorically empty at this point.
Okay, let's move on to Rashad in St. Louis. Rashad, thank you for waiting. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Thank you. Good morning. Two quick comments. One is with I recently saw a poll, I don't know if it was a Pew Research, but said that 60% of the Republicans believe that if you're in poverty, it's your own fault. And this is why, a lot of times, a lot of Republicans cheer when Newt Gingrich says Barack Obama's a food stamp president and make different comments, disparaging comments about the poor, because 60% of Republicans, they actually believe that it's your own fault. And secondly, how religion intersects our foreign policy in regards to how a lot of Christians, not particularly Catholics, but believe that the Bible should be used as a real estate document in regards to the Middle East, that God gave the land to the Jews. So as Romney said, he's not going to even press the issue if he becomes president of the United States. I just wanted to make those two comments, and I'll take my hands off there. Thank you.
All right. Anyone care to respond to Rashad? Julie, you were nodding.
Yes, I think that that's an unfortunate statistic. In the Catholic tradition, I think I don't think that there's any place for that. Rather, that we understand that there are structural causes of poverty, and there's not a lot of blame. I mean, even if you go back to the Gospels and everything that Jesus says about the poor, there's really nothing about what if they don't deserve it, or what if they're trying to take advantage of you, or something like that. It's just give, and I think if you look at this tradition of the Church, when they're on charity, it's all about my obligation and how it's important to my salvation to give. At the same time, I think that the Church has some wisdom on these issues, that we do need to work on issues of family and community and neighborhood and character, as well as at the structural level, and that we can address poverty best if we work from above and from below.
I think part of behind that comment was this sort of individualism, I think, that's presupposed, and I would connect it to the now famous takers and makers comment from Mitt Romney. And really what happens there is a simplistic categorization, I think, of the issue that, certainly we're all makers and takers. And I would affirm Julie the way she's speaking of the kind of communitarian vision of Catholic social thought that critiques individualism, but also critiques collectivism, and situates the human person in light of neighborhood, community, and also as having an obligation to the common good.
We have an email here from Janice who writes, "I attend Mass and hear the gospel again and again about social justice teachings of Jesus, yet I just received in our bulletin a very clear message from the bishops to vote Republican. Their reason is to stop abortion and the feigned religious liberty persecution in regards to the Affordable Care Act." Thoughts about that dictum from the pulpit?
With respect to the gospel's teaching on the poor, I think we need to distinguish between the corporal works of mercy, feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, visiting the prisoner, as these are incumbent upon us for the sake of our own souls. And they also have to do with a deep biblical teaching about the gifts that the poor can give us mm-hmm. in making us aware of our own dependency upon God and our own poverty in the face of God. This is very important. This is not the same as our duty to the common good, which is more complex and more nuanced and requires prudential judgment. About how to best serve the common good, which of course, and there we need to give a preferential option to the poor within our service of the common good. But I think it's important to distinguish between those two, and distinguish between the imperative that we engage the poor personally because of Jesus' command, and our own prudential judgments about what is best for the health of our society, with a special concern for the well-being of the poor.
I agree with Rusty that there's an important distinction, but I maybe wouldn't draw the line so starkly between the two, because it seems to me in stories like The Last Judgment in Matthew, where Jesus divides people into the sheep and the goats and says that those who haven't fed the hungry and clothed the naked, et cetera, are not going to have salvation. Certainly, the church has for the most part, interpreted that historically as our obligation to engage in the corporal works of mercy. But in our current situation today, what does that mean? Well, I think that it could very well mean that we have responsibility to support structural programs that could feed the hungry far more effectively than I can myself.
With regard to that last email, I have a note here asking, what about the church's tax status when it's preaching for whom to vote?
That's a difficult question, but yeah. But it's complicated. I think that the church should not be, and from what I've normally seen, does not endorse particular candidates or parties. They do help with the formation of conscience, and that's something the bishops, I think, do very well with their Guide on Faithful Citizenship, which is really a very nuanced document and gets at some of these issues of prudential judgment that Rusty is calling our attention to.
Okay, Rusty, a quick comment on that, or shall we move along?
No, I think that's right. I mean, the church is not in the business of endorsing particular candidates. Shouldn't be.
But apparently that was the case, according to the email that I just read, at least one case. Go ahead.
And I think that one of the problems we face is if I'm the bishop and I say that I cannot see how one can in good conscience vote for candidates that support abortion on demand, given the nature of the Democratic Party today, it's very difficult to find Democratic candidates to vote for who are pro-life. Mm-hmm. It's not saying vote for Mitt Romney, but that's a statement that tries to form people's consciences in a way that, and that what the effect of that, given the Democratic Party, is that it's very difficult for a person who agrees with that bishop to vote for a Democrat.
Okay. I have about 45 seconds left. Randy, I want to give you that time to talk about the forum on Thursday, 7 o'clock.
The forum is free and open to the public. We have my colleague here, Julie Rubio, will be on the panel. I will be moderating. Rusty Reno, who's on the phone, will be in town, as will William Cavanaugh from DePaul University and Father John Langan, a Jesuit from Georgetown University. We're going to continue these kinds of conversations, and again, we'll be featuring topics that are front and center during the election season, especially as they bear upon the common good. So please join us.
That's at 7 o'clock on Thursday at the Dunham Student Activity Center at Fadbon University. Randy Rosenberg, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Good luck at your forum on Thursday.
Thank you,
Julie Rubio, thank you so much for being with us. Nice to meet you and see you and talk to you. And Rusty Reno, we look forward to seeing you here in St. Louis on Thursday. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Great to be with you guys.
A reminder, by the way, that you can find more information about the current election cycle at beyondnovember.org, a collaboration of St. Louis Public Radio, the St. Louis Beacon, and the Nine Network of Public Media. Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll take a look at the current elections with NPR political junkie Ken Rudin. He'll be in St. Louis tomorrow along with Neil Conan. They'll do Talk of the Nation from right here at Grand Center. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don.